Welcome to Polycast, an official podcast of a Poulton Civilization site.
Daniel Quick.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
Hey, Madeline.
With guest co-hosts.
Mitos.
Nolan.
I was considering actually testing out whether or not I could play Civ and do the podcast at the same time, but I figured I might forget what I was doing, so better not. I think my computer could handle it.
Yeah, mine could. I couldn't, but my computer could. So, Mackie would like to do the introductions.
Oh, as usual, Dan's volunteering people. Welcome to Polycast, an official podcast of a Poulton Civilization site. This is episode 14. I'm still Makalua. Dan's still here today.
I am.
And with us for co-host today, we have Methos, who hopefully this time can remember what his password is on Poly, and username.
Hey, I remember it now. Now it's actually just Methos, not Methos from or of CFC. I can't remember which one it was.
Yeah, it was from.
Was it from?
Yep.
They changed it to something I can remember.
Dan is the greatest. Now you have to change it, sorry.
And if you were listening to the girls playing Civ over the Christmas holiday, you might remember our other co-hosts.
This is Nolan.
And who hasn't listened to the Christmas special, Mackie? What are you talking about?
Okay, the five people who haven't, but you know.
Oh, okay.
That'd be the five people that were in it. Do you listen to your own podcast?
Yes.
No. Part of it.
Actually, did you ever get around to listening to the episodes that you were in, Mathos? Because I think I remember the second time you were on, you said you guys still hadn't listened to the first one you were on.
I listened, like, part of it. Realized how much of an idiot I am and just quit listening.
Oh.
Now you know the experience I, Dan, and Imran, and K-Dad have every week.
So that was our moment of truth on Polycast. Mathos is an idiot.
And so are we.
I think everyone gets sensitized to their own voice on a recording.
Yeah, you're just like, oh my god.
Yeah, the first half dozen or so Polycasts I listened to after we recorded, I'm like, oh my god, I sound so stupid. And now I'm just accustomed to the sound of my own voice coming out of my own speakers. It doesn't even freak me out anymore.
In fact, quite the opposite.
No.
I'm afraid where that's going.
This is great. Max Civ 4 Warlords version 2.13 patch, now only 841 megabytes.
So it's just a whole CD and then some?
Someone actually thought in the comments on Inside Mat Games that they had accidentally just made the entire CD available, the entire ISO available, but just for anybody to download. And yeah, you have Warlords and it's patched, but apparently you do actually need Warlords in order for this to be able to work. There was one bug that was fixed in this. I definitely never saw it in the PC version. AI no longer dumps their entire nuclear arsenal on the barbarians.
That would be a neat one.
Describe yourself and Civ 4 leader traits. This was started by Wajir. And I guess it's only fair to limit yourself to two traits, just like leaders have two traits.
That's a tough one.
Well, I think I would be protective creative. The other characteristics don't quite cover it.
Wow. That's crazy. I actually have creative and protective. The order is just reverse.
Are we all going to be creative protective? Just that his other traits don't fit. Yes, I like to go play Warmonger and Civ, but in real life, I'm a nice get-along person.
Well, I run a website for contests for city building games, and so I'm very protective of my little group of people. And offline, I like to do a lot of digital graphics and other art type things.
I'm thinking I'd probably be protective and financial.
Show me the money.
Especially now when you have a kid, you become a lot more protective anyway. You watch things a lot more closely. The financial just goes well. Yeah. Financial creative is kind of equal. It's hard to tell between the two. But as Mackie said, a lot of these traits, I just can't see doing in real life. Like expansive, I guess if I had a bunch of kids, maybe.
materialistic. I don't know. Your own empire going there.
Do any of you play unrestricted leaders? If so, what would be your choice in them? In multiplayer, that's a recent favorite. Put it on random and you wonder who you are and what traits you have.
I wake up that way, so I really don't play games like that.
In the news, we look at Sid Meier's three most important moments in gaming, according to him, and Civilization Revolution previews galore.
In Forum Talk, we talked about espionage and whether or not we change the slider. We also discussed the PAs and whether or not they make the game too easy or, in some conditions, too hard. And what simulation unit do you miss the most between the last version, Civ 1, 2, 3, and all of their expansions?
Oh, in the Senate, we talked about whether we would have a forge in every city, what to do about rat traps, and whether one would go to rifles or grenadiers.
Lastly, in the theater, in-game blunders from Civilization 4, but led off with a tale from an adventure in Civilization 3.
Here's what's been making news in the Civ community.
I did go through all of these CivRev previews that have been linked here. Two things that were interesting in terms of their differences. One was the control scheme, the controls, and the other was multiplayer. Two of the previewers did not find the control scheme very intuitive, the first being Dan Su over at 1UP.com, and the other one was Wired's Chris Kohler, who said there is a decent learning curve to the controls, whereas all the other individuals seem to have a consensus that the control scheme was intuitive, that you'd pick it up quite easily. But the thing that was really even more interesting than that was the concern, in a way, about multiplayer and whether or not you had to wait for every other player in a multiplayer environment before you could take your turn. From what I'm following here, those who are saying that you have to wait are not aware of the turn timer. Andy Eddy from Team Xbox says that you can turn the timer off for deep micromanagement by the participants, or you can have it on where the long timer gives players 2 minutes to do their housekeeping, and the short gives each person just 15 seconds.
That's more like blazing time, not beyond the sword.
Yeah, and it was one of these individuals actually referred to CivRev as a real-time strategy game and all previous Civs as real-time strategy. Maybe he was playing on the short timer where he just had 15 seconds and that's why he got confused. Because in a way that sounds like to me, if you're playing on short with multiplayer and it's just 15 seconds, that's got to bleed in a little bit of an RTS feeling.
That's what it's like if you play normal Civ on GameSpy. Everybody wants blazing, blazing, blazing.
Or a good number of the games are played on quick. But blazing is something that they take on for challenges.
You know, they never did ask if they could use my last name to name that game Speed. Kind of annoyed about that. I still haven't received any royalties. As far as which one I enjoyed reading the most of all of these previews, I found Dan's at 1UP.com the most enjoyable because there is actually a narrative element to it, a lot of Dear Diary sort of entries, where he actually talks more about the multiplayer game that they played.
How many multiplayers can play in there at one time?
Four players, multiplayer, three different modes, free-for-all, head-to-head, and teams.
So they've got a cap at four?
Yes.
Well, it probably has something to do with the number of controllers you could actually have plugged in on a console at the same time.
Oh, yeah. True. I don't play consoles.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of CivRevCast. I've been... I think it's time to move on.
Yes.
I think you're the only one of us that actually really pays attention to CivRev.
There's always questions about it, and it's good to have some idea of what it's all about. And maybe it might even tip us off on what another iteration of a civilization for the PC might be.
Absolutely. So if CivRev screws things up, it's only console. In other news, Sid talks about the three most important moments in gaming in his his opinion. His first is that IBM making the personal computer. Second was the development of SimCity and other games that encourage construction rather than just destruction. And the third was Nintendo's official seal of quality, which I hadn't actually heard of before. Apparently, it was a 1980 stamp of gaming quality that helped, as it said, counter the flow of bad games that had drowned out so many previous video game consoles.
Well, that's what happened with 1983 and the whole video game industry crash, is because a bunch of companies who didn't know hardly anything about computers and definitely didn't know anything about gaming all tried to cash in on it because they thought it was the next big thing. Nobody was buying anything because the games were still, this is still in the cartridge era of games, and they were expensive, and nobody wanted to buy it if it was going to end up being a crappy game if they only wanted to play for 10 minutes. So Nintendo, on their system, saying, you know, we looked at this, this is a good game, putting that on was actually a thing. Can't think of a good equivalent for what it is, but it did help. Because even if you were going to spend $50, you knew it wouldn't be quite as crappy as everything else that was out there.
There was a crash in 83. Got it. This article was actually really interesting to read. I find it interesting that his wife doesn't play games at all. I found it odd, though, that MTV had a reporter there. I didn't think MTV would deal in this sort of... I mean, they do often will advertise, like, Grand Theft Auto, stuff like that, but I can't see MTV finding interest in Civ.
Yeah, and this article appears on MTV.com.
Yeah.
There was actually a part where he said that during the lunch, someone had said that someone from MTV was there, and the Sid's response was, okay, cool, apparently.
Well, see, now that it's going to be on a console, Civ is now all sexy or something.
Maxim was there, Popular Mechanics, AOL.
Ah.
Quite a few programmers at the developers play many games. Developers often have libraries of games for everyone to take home and play or sample so they keep abreast of everything, but I can see why Mrs. Myers wouldn't be interested after dealing with the people issues all the time and management. She's not into the job for the games. She's into the job for the people.
Talking about this lunch and gaming talk for an hour was at the Algonquin Hotel. Apparently, Sid ordered the tuna.
Yep. There's a Sid sushi joke in there somewhere, I know it.
Got news? Email news@apolton.net or send a private message to Dan Q, Locutus, or one of the other news editors.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot SIV issues in the forums.
Espionage. Do you change the slider? This is what Minmaster wants to know. Am I the only one who leaves it at 0%? I can't bring myself to sacrifice research income for espionage. So far, there's a break. There's a yes, no, and sometimes temporarily with no, and sometimes temporarily pretty well neck and neck.
You know, I never used to mess with the slider until a few podcasts ago. You guys did an article where you discussed the thief economy succession game, thing that happened back in August of last year. And I read the majority of that, and I was actually very impressed with what they were able to do with espionage. I've been tempted to try a game like that, but it does make me realize that using the espionage slider is actually worth it, even though I've never really done it before.
Yeah, even a modest 10% in there once you start meeting other civilizations, the game is good because it helps you keep track of how they're doing, and you can see how much they're putting in towards you as well. Especially at the point later on, once you've invested some time and some points to it, they accumulate slowly, but when you get around to the point where you might want to start warring them in the mid-game, you may actually have line of sight in their cities and be able to actually see how many troops they have.
Now, I have used the slider, like, a couple of times just to find out what people are researching. So, you know, but other than that, I typically don't really use it, or I don't think 10% is anything I've ever gone above.
In multiplayer, I don't think it's used as often because the cost, say, to steal tech, that would be one of the reasons for using the spies. If they brought down the cost of the espionage actions, there'd be more of it. But for the most part, I haven't heard of many people using the espionage slider very much.
Well, in regards to the multiplayer with espionage, I'm kind of curious because I know in your single-player game, whenever you do raise your espionage slider, the AI will actually counter it and try and equal yours. In multiplayer, can they also tell that you've actually raised your slider and are looking more, you know, putting more scratch points towards them so that way they can counter it, or can they tell?
Well, in a poly diplo game, I had sent a great spy across borders to see how big the Pangea was and who was where. And at one point he died, so I know somebody's discovered him and got rid of him, and it was a no AI game, so I'm not quite so sure how they found him and killed him. They must have had a spy of their own in the city that they went through.
For me, I play at Noble Level, and I'm single player, and Builder type as well has been established on previous episodes. Early to mid-game, for me, there's a 50-50 chance. I'll keep it at zero, or I'll raise it as 10%, although I definitely would wait until I actually ran into someone that I think might be a threat to me, which actually might almost be anybody. But again, early to mid-game, as soon as an espionage point building comes along, I'm talking, you know, courthouse, jail, and then even looking later on, we're talking about security bureau and intelligence agency, I typically build them first in my city so long as they have the production means to do so within a reasonable amount of time. Certainly my espionage level at this point is never enough to steal technologies. In fact, I don't even try to go for that. I just focus on researching them myself and knowing where my opponents are as far as their technology goes. I also use that to find out not only where they are technologically so I can try to keep up, but also for trade purposes. I always like, oh, hey, this person is one turn away from discovering that technology. Why don't I trade that to them now for a lot of gold? Just because I know they're going to have it anyway, so I might as well be able to cash in on it.
So Dan exploits the system.
Damn right. But really, I think a major benefit for having your spy slider above 0% is, first, I don't feel the need to have to go for the Great Wall, for example. For espionage points, I'd much rather be building some other early wonder. Later game, I've done 20 to even 40% espionage, but that's where I'm at a notable disadvantage militarily, but I'm generally at par or ahead of technology as compared to others. And as someone who is very interested in more of the passive means of espionage as opposed to direct ones, I find the espionage slider very helpful in that respect.
In late game and single player, I'll also bump it up a bit more because if I have somebody who's close behind me and I'm going for like space race or diplomacy or something, I'll use poison water to slow them down. Because it not only slows down their research, but you have an opponent that you're trying to get voted head in for the diplomatic victory, you can reduce the number of votes they have that way.
Good idea.
Seems like the majority of these posters never go above 20%. Usually maybe someone will hit 10%. Now, as a man 333, he says single player he rarely uses a slider, but multiplayer definitely.
I have to wonder what he's doing with that espionage in multiplayer.
I don't know. Go play a game against him and see how he plays. Or have you played with him?
No.
That did not sound right.
Both of your minds are currently stuck in the gutter.
Neldrith, he actually says that when he's preparing for a war, he'll turn his slider to 100% for a couple turns, 5 to 10, only to rack in all the EP I can, then he goes back to either 0 or 10%.
For the long-term part of it, when you're not at war, that's all you need because you keep accumulating the points to where you can see their research and stuff. It's when you get to the point where you're at war and you need it for missions is where you bump it up, because then the rest of the time you can use that extra money for your research.
You mentioned that you're also like to have the espionage slider up so you can see where the line of sights into cities is excellent, because not only can I know what numbers of units they have, but also where they are located. PAs make the game too easy. That's not a public announcement, making the game too easy. PA, referring to permanent alliances. Sir Snuggles.
Oh, the username sometimes.
Oh, well.
I've been wanting to say that all time. Asked, what do others think about this? On the one hand, my two Emperor games, the AI seems to shack up quicker. And I don't know if I meant shack up quicker. This is a family-friendly show. Which gives them an initial tech advantage, but I find that by the time I find a friend, maybe 100 turns later with a smaller backwards one, to ally with, I start teching like a beast. For those wondering, what is a permanent alliance? Become one nation with two rulers. Each civilization controls its own units and city still, but you share everything else. Resources, technology, maps. Victory or defeat and are bound by the other's declarations of war and peace treaty signing. And PAs become possible after researching communism. I don't know about everyone else, but I disagree that permanent alliances make the game too easy. Why? The infrequency in which they appear.
I was going to say, I'm usually too paranoid to get into an alliance with them, because what if they stab me in the back? I don't know.
They can also make the game more challenging. At Arhoff, we had a recent game, the Gauntlet 32, that was rather interesting. What we did was, the game was set up as where you played an OCC, one city challenge, but you had to win it by a culture victory. Which, of course, the only way to do that is through PAs. And it was really interesting reading people's write-ups on their games because, well, not always can you get your AI people to actually put enough culture in their city to make it go quickly. A lot of times you're always, you know, you're having to fight off the other people or do other things while you're waiting for your partner to achieve two legendary cities.
You know, there's also the problem that your AI partner may just like to get into wars a lot.
PAs can also be a lot of fun and add challenge to the game if you go for odd victories like OCC domination.
Otherwise, what civ would you have a permanent alliance with? I would be afraid to be allied with a warlock leader.
Monty.
And be dragged into their into their challenges with others. Or would you have a permanent alliance with a weak or a stronger nation?
What happens if you have a PA with two different civs that go to war with each other? Because you can't really go to war with yourself.
This is where all of our ignorance and permanent alliances shows up. We don't know.
Yes, I don't know what to say. I don't know how that works.
PAs can be fun. I've never played a PA that wasn't like an OCC game. I've never actually signed in with a permanent alliance in just a normal game.
Has anyone ever seen even in single-player AIs permanently ally with each other? I haven't seen that either, in addition to my never even having the option to be able to do so.
I've seen it a few times.
How'd that work out for you?
Well, I'm like you. I'm more of a builder, so I don't really go to wars that much. I will go to war. Usually it seems like it's more the weaker ones. You don't usually get like Monty or someone like that that will sign it in a PA with someone. Usually I just stay away from them. If they have a PA, I stay away from them.
Because even in games where I've shared religions, I've had defensive packs since you could with military tradition, and even been in wars, on the same side, of course, with other says, even over dozens of turns, I've never actually seen the permanent alliance option be possible.
The option that comes so late in the game.
Yeah, that's the other reason.
I think the times whenever I actually saw the AI sign a PA is whenever I also had signed a PA.
Which civilization unit do you miss the most? PibZ asks, so which unit do you miss the most from any previous iteration of Civ, be it for graphical or for general use? He cites the Alpine Troop, the Caravan, and the Flak Cannon. And that's the Alpine Troop and the Caravan from Civ 2 and the Flak Cannon from Civ 3 and Conquests specifically. Now, I have to admit that I never built the Alpine Troop. In Civ 2, but after reading up on it a little bit, I kind of wish I had. But I don't miss the Caravan.
Yeah, that unit sucked. I remember, that's one of the few units I actually remember. What was that, Civ 2?
Hoops nerd? I agree where he says, although he calls it Civ 3 Warlords, oops, he misses the horse units you got from the Statue of Zeus in Civ 3. Yeah, I miss those too.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about those.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was ridiculously overpowered for the time that they were there. Oh, wait, that's the reason I missed them. Oh, no.
I honestly don't remember much about Civ 3. Been a couple of years since I played. Ever since Civ 4 came out, I pretty much have put away Civ 3.
Jimbo27 says, I like the crappy triremes from Civ 2 that could enter ocean but would have a random chance of getting sunk each turn they ended on an ocean tile.
Well, those were fun.
Yeah, you might get lucky and it would survive all the way across to a new land.
Well, I always said it was usually whenever mine sunk, it was when I was just the very next turn I would get in a safe land. You know, I was just one turn away and then would sink. It's like, damn it.
And if you put any other units on it, it was like a double jinx.
Ladies, man. He says that, oh yes, there are many from Cult of Power I missed. The entire Future Age, for instance.
Wait, I thought we were talking about Civ units, not Call to Power.
Controversy. Well, maybe on the forums, not here.
Civ 4 has so many units, and the X-Packs have introduced many more. I don't miss a whole lot of anything from Conquest, which is my only previous Civ experience. And they've done such a wonderful job. With the mods, you can probably take just about any unit and combine it. You have your artwork already.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
Do you build a forge in every city? I agree, yes, if I can do it easily enough and early enough.
I get there eventually, but I prioritize the cities that are already high hammer producing to make them produce even faster, usually.
I will eventually, but it also depends on what type of game I'm playing. If I'm playing a game for a Hoth that I put on Smash of the Hoth, then I will only build a forge in a city if it's worth it. But if I'm just playing for fun, like a lot of times I'll just pull up a Prince game or something, just play, don't really have anything, then yeah, I'll probably end up putting a forge in every city. Of course, that's when I usually put everything in every city. It just depends on what type of game I'm playing.
And for me, it doesn't matter on what type of game I'm playing. I will build a forge in every city, not just in those cities that are already doing well production-wise to be even more so, but to help some of those cities that, without it, not so good production-wise, but with it really helps give it a kickstart. I mean, we're talking about, what, 120 hammer cost here? Can also give the option of turning a citizen into an engineer, which is helpful. Plus 25 hammers, but of course, if you happen to have gems, gold, silver, there's also the plus one happiness, and I think often a lot of people forget that. As Zephyr says, to me the question isn't will I build a forge, it is when will I build a forge.
Yes, I agree.
Mm-hmm.
For me, in new cities, once available, generally speaking, I'll build a library first, and then the forge, because then, for example, it makes building markets faster. I know some people like Digital Boy say it's a low priority in commerce-dedicated cities. I'd rather have a market or a bank faster. And often I find that building the forge first, the turns that it takes to build the forge reduces the turns that it would then take to build a market, that if I just built the market from the beginning, I could have had a forge and a market in the same amount of turns or even less than if I just gone to a market straight away.
Yes. Would you try and build one in a rat trap city?
So, are you starting? Well, not as of yet, but they don't change their approach to agriculture. It won't be too long before many of their people go hungry. The fascinating thing is that there is a large piece of fertile soil in the south of the country that would be ideal for tuber cultivation, you know.
Sorry.
Tuber? Tuber, yeah, tuber. It is indigenous to the planet. It's like a potato.
This eternal spark, every once in a while I'm playing a game and I see a potential base location that would be pretty nice, except that it's on the ice and the bonuses are furs, and, you know, that's just not the food potential there to do anything with this area. I call these spots rat traps.
I'll generally build in rat trap cities of the polar areas if it means access to a coast that I didn't have access to before, and also if it has resources that are desperately needed. But this is talking about multiplayer. I don't know how you would approach that with a single player.
Well, even in single player, like with that iron resource, if that was going to be my only access to iron, and there didn't seem to be any other reasonable way to get iron, I would settle it closer to the iron away from the coast. But part of what you said as well, if I don't have access to that coast otherwise, but even if I do, I'm going to settle that on the coast because on the water, you build yourself a lighthouse and you've got 2 food per tile. So the city actually has a chance to grow. And then if you're concerned about, well, sure, it's growing, but it doesn't have the resources, well, then, for example, build your forge and you can have one of your citizens turn into an engineer, and that can help you along.
My rat trap cities, if I build them, usually I'll try and position them in such a way that they'll have at least maybe 2 good tiles. And a lot of times I'll just give them just enough food to where they can support a couple specialists and then just leave them there. And they pretty much will build just about nothing. They're just there for the resources, to either, for me, the resources, or to deny the AI resources. And they will just sit there as a size, you know, 2 to 5 city, and that's about it. And they'll never build anything, but maybe wealth or research or whatever it is best for that city. and that's all that city will ever be. That's another reason why I'll build rat trap cities and try and make them support themselves.
Or to take the area, if you really need the points.
I think building a city on a rat trap, maybe an AI will try to sneak a city in there, which is so annoying, but especially when it comes to the iron, it's not going to grow to be a productive city. It's going to be there to allow other cities to be more productive.
Well, not just iron. I mean, even some, like, other resources that you might be able to do really good with trading.
Oh, yeah.
You know, as long as the city has a positive income, netting me something, then I'll possibly build it. But you know, I don't just go out there and build a bunch of rat trap cities. It's usually just I might have one or two. A lot of times up at like tundra or something like that, you'll have like two or three food resources up there, coastal. Plop one down to use them both and just have it be a small GP farm.
I assume you're not referring to whales, though.
No, because they're too far. Too far in the future.
These people are digging a mine across the border. The coal resources straddle the border between my country and his. Barely, they go 3 miles into my country, which your people are happily tunneling into. It has been a point of contention between us, okay? But it is just a difference in cartographic interpretation. Tomato, tomato. No, no, it's pretty clear cut. You entered illegally into my country. You gave me no choice. You refused to negotiate.
Oh, you mean giving?
What do you care anyway? It's not like your people are going to use the coal.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
You needed to power your medieval steam engine.
Grenaders versus Riflemen by Crazy. He's asking the opinion of other people on whether or not you would go Grenaders or Riflemen first.
Well, I'd go Riflemen, basically, because they're quicker for me to get in the multiplayer and very versatile for upgrades and everything. And quite often I'll be drafting.
Yeah, same here. True, Grenadiers don't cost quite as much, so perhaps in some circumstances, some cities that aren't quite so productive, maybe you would prefer to build them so you could actually get some units out there. I don't draft units, but certainly that's an advantage to Riflemen over Grenadiers as well. As Civic Nut points out, I agree. Grenadier may beat a Rifleman, but he will lose when a Rifleman attacks. Of course, that's assuming that the Rifleman isn't severely damaged as compared to the Grenadier. You know what we mean. And a Rifleman will fare a whole lot better against an attack by cavalry. Again, Riflemen having a 25% bonus versus them. Also, as a builder, the only advantage I ever saw to Grenadiers was in combat situation, where it's also allowing you to get you closer to cannons, but, again, not being quite the warmonger. And even from what I understand, Grenadiers were more preferable to be built before Beyond the Sword. I forget exactly the reason why. I think if I end up with Grenadiers, it's because I accidentally selected it instead of a Rifleman.
This gets into espionage. If you know you're going to be visited by a stack of Grenadiers, you certainly would like to know enough so you can counter them. It depends on the era, and from multiplayer, we'll usually select an era. It's rare to go from ancient to space race.
And it depends on how long you stay in that little, I guess Napoleonic era would be a good way to put it. Because if you just go through it really quickly and you're already up to infantry, then there's no point in going back for Grenadiers. But if you're in that for an extended period of time and the AI will come at you with Riflemen, then the Grenadiers are good for your defense, trying to whittle down their stacks. I guess it's all situational again.
Basically, you two, Gloria and Mackie, you guys choose on what you're going to build compared to what you're facing, or what you're expecting to face compared to which one you prefer.
Right. And generally, I can, with using passive espionage, I get an idea of what everybody else is building in multiplayer, and it gives me a general idea of what I might be seeing.
It's one of those multiplayer things that also applies very well to single player.
There's a good way for competitive play and have other people give you advice. That's the Bulletin University.
And we would find that where? Jeez.
Bulletin.net/forums.
Really? Wow. How could I figure that out from a Bulletin University?
I don't know.
Sometimes I wonder. Be seated in the theater where co-hosts share their gameplay experiences.
Lars asks, what are the biggest blunders? It's like, good lord. I remember this is a Civ 3 game. Civ 3, I don't know if it was a blunder or not, but I was going for a 20k And one of the biggest, the runaway civs that was just going to war with everybody. And he dialed on me. I thought I could win because I only had like 13 turns until victory. But he was way ahead of me in tech, he was way ahead of me in units, so I just started throwing everything I could at my border just to slow him down and keep him away from my 20k city. And he ended up wiping out all my units to the point where I had no resources, so I was throwing at him like, you know, it was whatever you could build with no resources. And I won, but I was like, you know, 4 turns from dead.
I started the game on Deity once. I can fill in the blanks.
How far did you make it?
Somewhere around 100 turns in.
When did you realize the mistake?
Somewhere around 100 turns in.
somewhere around 100 turns.
Well, I keep forgetting to build an army along with the forge and the granaries and what have you. Also forget when my cities start getting red faces. If it wants to grow, I forget to turn off growth when I micromanage my cities and discover, aha, I might have been able to pick up 3 more population. But I seem to do that more often lately.
One big blunder that I remember that was very, very angering, I was playing a Hoth game, and the culture of victory was, I was going to get it, it was like 1200 ADs, forgot exactly what year, and I had been watching the Dom limit like crazy. And it got just to that point where my first city popped legend, so I used all my grid arrows to pop all the rest of my other 2 cities to legendary, so all 3 hit legendary. And I'm like, yes, I won. I hit the button, and it says, you have won a domination victory. I was like, damn it. I submitted it anyway, so I had like a 1200 AD domination win, you know? Yeah, apparently they choose domination before culture. That was very upsetting. I still remember that. That was like a year ago. Actually, there's so many blunders, it's hard to remember them all.
Yeah, this is just like the highlights of our blunders. There's so many others.
Yeah.
Well, in multiplayer, it's kind of fun to listen to everybody else, and you can hear the blunders and the shouting and the cursing and the, I'm going to quit, Civ. And you wonder what they did. Being in voice chat with a team is really fun. Even helps you remember to do the things that they've already goofed on.
Winston Hughes says, getting dogpiled because I failed to notice that my victim had a defensive pack. It's dumb as hell.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, I've done that a few times.
Yep. Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY. In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at the Polycast or email us at polycast@polton.net.
For more information on Polycast, our sibling show, Modcast,
log on to the series' official website at polycast.polton.net. Worst start ever? Nintendo Togepi. So this is a quick, easy OCC settler game. It's a Hoenakapak on a fractal map. It says all is good, right? But when the game loads, we're stuck on a single tile island. But they do have bananas, so that's okay. It's a jungle. The one tile they've got. And fish. That would be in the BFC or the Big Fat Cross. I think that's a bad start, but not as bad as a follow-up. Apparently, since this was as a result of a random map, it's considered ineligible by Major General 2. Maybe I don't understand their conditions for deciding on what the worst start is, but that is definitely bad.
Oh, my God.
That,
you know, I think I had a start like that in Civ 2 one time when I tried to play on Deity. It put me on the North Pole. And I'm like, where am I supposed to go?
Wow.
Well, my worst start was as a multiplayer team game. I like to play against the AI sometimes for practice, and I chose continents. And when I launched, I discovered my AI teammates were on the other continent, and I was with my enemies all by myself.
Oh.
And it said it always wore. So that was a wake-up call for me. A good chance to learn some military. I can't remember if I lived very long or not. It was just a... I don't want to play continents and get shifted over to the enemies.
How about that one game, Smitty258? He's stuck on the island, which is a hill, so you plains hill, so he starts out with two hammers. But, boy, he's got three crabs, three fish in his BFC.
Yeah, he would, so I don't know what he's complaining about. I mean, it's not worst start ever.
Yeah, I'd play it out just out of curiosity.
As he also said, other land is also within sight, so...
Yeah.
Just beeline to sailing.
Yeah.
Basically, that position right there is something similar to one of the Skama games we played. Think about that. You head straight for bronze working, go into the slavery civic, and build tons of work boats, and you can whip crap like crazy with that city. All that extra food.
Have any of you done any modding?
Kind of, but not really. I've helped on a mod, but it was a Hoff mod, and I just did the stuff I could do. I left most of my work to Dennis and Gyather.
I've thought about a couple of times about doing some maps from some other games I've played for custom maps for Civ, and then I look at the way I'd have to do the map and I run, because I'm like, I can't handle it. Which is odd, because I can mod in other games just fine, but the Civ, I just get all...
Gloria, the fact that you included me in that question was very thoughtful.
Dan mods the game to the World Builder.
Well, it isn't easy to do, but mods are very interesting. I've played a few, but I don't play them all.
I have a little cutie to just walk in.
Does he or she want to be on the show? You have been listening to the 40th episode of Polycast. That's right, the big 4-0. I'm Daniel Quick, known as Dan Q on the forums. I've been joined by Mackie.
Bye-bye.
And two returning guest co-hosts this week, Mathos.
That was Mathos' little one. Little Mathos.
Mini Mathos.
Sorry, Mommy went in the room, so.
That timing was perfect. Nobody's going to think that wasn't edited in.
Okay, well, this is Mathos and Little Mathos saying bye.
And by Gloria, Condor 223 on Apolton, and Nolan over at CFC.
Yes, oh, goodbye, everyone.
Sorry.
I should get my cat in on this. He talks to me during multiplayer games.
So now that you've been on a regular Polycast episode of Gloria, would you agree to do this again?
Sure. I don't know that I have a whole lot of things to share with you because of the multiplayer aspect. And
they keep inviting me back, so don't count that as a turn down.
Hey, we have Imran on here. He never plays Civ.
How many games a day do you play?
Can we measure that in fractions?
Cash in on it because I thought it was the next big thing. So you had this whole year where there was just who's ringing.
Alrighty then, welcome back, Imran.
Imran's here. Oh yeah, I forgot the whole thing. You know, our house. I put on the headphones and I hear, "Welcome back, Imran." I'm like, "Oh, hey, Imran's here."
There is an iron resource.
Oh.
You too.
Someone was saying hi.
Hello.
They said hi back.
And a...
Wow, Dan made his own blooper.
In Forum Talk, we talked about espionage, whether or not we... Yeah, that sucked.
Thank heavens for Dan's editing.
Record date March 15th, 2008. Sound clips copyright Civilization 4, The Warlords, and the Beyond the Sword expansion packs. Stargate Atlantis clips copyright MGM Global Holdings Incorporated. Copyright 2008, Bolton Civilization site at bolton.net.